Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Josh Leposky, co-author, along with Max Liboron, of Discard Studies, Wasting Systems and Power, published this year by MIT Press. Dr. Leposky, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's excellent to be here.
All right. So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Sure. I'm a professor of geography at Memorial University of Newfoundland and Labrador, and I've been researching and writing in the area of discard studies for a number of years. My personal research has been focused on electronic discards, I would say a lot of the conceptualization of that topic has come out of the broader field of discard studies, which I was introduced to via my co-author, Max Liboron, and have learned a great deal from, certainly. And eventually, we decided it was time to take what had been a co-edited blog site to a full book. And here we are.
All right. And since Dr. Liboron wasn't able to join us today, could you talk just a little bit about kind of what each of you contributed to the project and how you worked together to produce the final book?
Yes, it's unfortunate that Max can't be here. This really is a product of co-thinking and writing. And we both, Max and I, while we work in the area of discard studies, we do work on different topics. Max has been focused on ocean plastics and plastics more broadly, as well as indigenous methodologies and their research. Goes in quite different directions than my own on electronics, but we definitely share concepts and ideas around discard studies. So I'm not sure if that answered your question sufficiently, but I guess I would just add that, again, while this was definitely a project of co-thinking and writing, Max and I don't necessarily always think exactly the same about discard studies. So what goes today is really very much my perspective on the field, and Max might have other things to say if they could be here.
All right. To get into the content of the book now, you describe it in the introduction as, in part, an attempt to unsettle the popular mythologies of waste. So can you tell us what are these mythologies of waste and why do they need to be unsettled?
Yeah. Well, one of the most sort of immediate ones is unsettling this idea that this sort of nebulous we know who what waste is. And the reason Max and I felt this needs to be unsettled is that, we have, as individuals, perhaps as families, a very, deep and visceral familiarity with things we think of as waste. We're putting stuff in the trash can, maybe a recycling bin. Often these are, very mundane tasks that maybe we don't think too much about because they seem so everyday. They're not necessarily pleasant. There can be a lot of sensorial things that go along with them. Things smell badly, etc. So waste, if we think about it at all, we tend to sort of pass off as not very meaningful. And again, because we're touching it in all of these sorts of things all the time, we think we know it. However, that kind of waste, say in our households, or putting in trash cans or where, what have you, is a very small percentage of overall waste arising. Really, that what's going into our bins is what typically gets referred to as municipal solid waste. And even though, if you've seen pictures or been to a landfill yourself, the amount of waste going into that landfill may seem massive, and in some senses it is. But by far the most waste has come into being long before you and I as individuals have purchased, this or that commodity, whether it's food or, in my case, an electronic device. Most of the waste has occurred upstream in manufacturing, and before that in mining. So the first move that we had to make in this book was to try and, as we say, unsettle or defamiliarize people with what they think waste is.
All right. Yeah. And so then you take that into a discussion of scale, because we see waste at one scale, and that might lead us to think, a certain sort of solution might fit that. And it doesn't necessarily address what's going on at these other sorts of scales.
Yes. Yes. So scale is a really key concept in discard studies, and we talk about it at length in the book. And I think especially, so myself as a geographer, for sure, this was one of the concepts in learning from discard studies that was, in a way, the hardest for me to overcome, where I was at with my understanding of scale as a geographer, since that, those listening to the podcast who are geographers may know about the scale debates that go on in the field. And even for all of those debates that go on within geography itself, there's still a tendency in those debates and is sort of outside geography as a field to think of scale and size as kind of interchangeable concepts. And in discard studies, we try to think about scale differently, where relative size may or may not be sort of the main issue in play. So we talk about scale not in terms of relative size, but as the relationships that matter. And we have a couple of analogies that we explore in the book. You might have, for example, an elephant, a virus, and water. And for the virus, capillary action moving through, say, the veins of an elephant is, those are the relationships that matter much more than the size of the elephant in terms of moving through the elephant's body, for example. So we just try to think about scale a little bit differently. And the reason that this is important is when it comes to discard is that very, very often one of the solutions put forward to solve waste problems defaults to recycling, and in particular, consumer, post-consumer recycling. And when you look at the relative, and here's where we have to make a distinction between scale and magnitude. When you look at the relative magnitude of waste arising in post-consumer compared to upstream in manufacturing and mining before that, recycling post-consumer waste can never match up to the magnitude of total waste arising from mining and manufacturing. So we in the book, we talk about a scalar mismatch. It's not that recycling, certainly the argument we're making is not that recycling is bad or wrong or something or shouldn't be done, but that the relationship that it has with the magnitude of the waste, overall waste problem doesn't match up. So scale needs to be thought of in terms of the relationships that matter.
Yeah, and you make an interesting point that one of the relationships that recycling has is that it can facilitate the sort of approach to disposability of products that it's, you know, in theory supposed to be trying to solve.
Yeah, that's right. So there's a lot packed into what you're saying there. You know, when you look at recycling, what has come to be, you know, post-consumer recycling or curbside recycling in, you know, the United States, lots of Europe or Canada, there was historically a lot of resistance early on from industry. And there, you know, there are excellent historical analyses of this. But relatively quickly, various industries realized that what post-consumer recycling offered was a way to move products through households as opposed to into households, which, of course, is excellent for the bottom line of corporations, right? Who are making products that are increasingly disposable. If you turn the marketing problem not into something like how do we get someone to bring it into their home, but turn it into something about how do we move it through households, then recycling can actually shore up disposability as opposed to being a solution to it. I mean, it's not an accident that, you know, the waste hierarchy that so many of us learn from when we're very young, even in elementary school, of reduce, reuse, recycle, that so frequently the emphasis is on recycle, and there's, you know, reduction gets its mention, but it rarely gets its practice, if you will.
Right. And even the reduction part can only do so much if we're treating that as a kind of instruction to the consumer, you know, and their
That's right. I mean, this is another thing that we get into in various places in the book is the way that solutions that are offered for waste issues are very often framed in terms of individualist action, and that the responsibility is on you as the individual consumer to you know, reduce and recycle what you are being blamed for in terms of you know, consuming this or that commodity. And certainly, you know, we're not making an argument that personal responsibility is not important at all. But what we are pointing out is that at the individual level, it doesn't matter if we all achieve 100% recycling, because most of the waste has happened before we've purchased this or that commodity. And also, it's important, as we discuss in the book, to think through the differences in power that are, how to put it, I guess, bundled up with solutions that are framed as individual responsibility only. You know, when large corporations and individual consumers are placed side by side as if they are, you know, two different individuals, as it were. That is, again, not an accident, and it erases the differences in power that those two actors have. And so one of the arguments that we make in the book is that it is crucial to analyze differences in power in that respect.
Yeah, so you're kind of anticipating actually the next question that I wanted to ask, which is about the role of power. And you describe discarding as a technique of power, as a, you know, power deciding what gets discarded and how it gets discarded. So can you say a little bit more about the importance of power to discarding and how that relates to different sort of social arrangements?
Yeah. So I think that the issue of power is perhaps one point where, and we can come back to this if you like, but where for me, there is a difference between what we're calling discard studies in the book and what elsewhere might be called waste studies. And while I'm not super interested in sort of policing boundaries between fields, there is a difference to me between discard studies and waste studies in that discard studies has come to mean for Max and I a way of understanding how systems work as opposed to waste in a more, let's say, conventional or everyday language sense of the term, whether that's a curbside pickup of garbage or trash or recycling, that sort of thing. And so your initial question there was about power. I think maybe it's helpful to tell a little bit of a origin story, I guess, for how the shift in my conceptual thinking kind of came about here. And that was probably around between 2016 and 2018, when I was reading from my own work around work on critical algorithm studies, and also in work on commercial content moderation of social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc., from a variety of authors who, you know, I wouldn't necessarily think initially of as discard studies authors. But when I learn more and more about how content moderation actually works, where despite all of the kind of hype around the use of computer algorithms to do the content moderation, that is the cleaning up of social media feeds to get rid of content that would otherwise violate companies' community use policies, for example, hateful content, sexually explicit, etc. It became relatively clear to me that this is a type of discarding. We're not talking, when it comes to commercial content moderation, we're not talking about waste or trash in the conventional sense, but there is a, you know, there are explicit references to cleaning up, to getting rid of. And for me, that was a moment where I kind of made this leap to, okay, discard studies is actually something different than, in this sense, than thinking about waste in the more conventional sense. And it became a way, discard studies became a way for me to think about, okay, this is a way of thinking about how systems work. Any system, in order to be the system that it is, it has to get rid of people, places, and things. And it was in conversation then with Max over, you know, those years between, say, as I say, 2016-ish and beyond, where I think together we really started thinking more broadly about discard studies than conventional forms of waste or trash. To go back to the question of power, just in that, you know, in that example of commercial content moderation, there are very clear examples of deeply uneven power relationships that, you know, from a, let's say, a labor studies point of view, might be more apparent. So commercial content moderators for Twitter and for Facebook, there's been, you know, fantastic investigative reporting into this. There's been, you know, excellent academic studies of this. But typically, the people who are employed doing the content moderation, they are hired by third-party contract employment agencies. So an individual content moderator may be doing work for, say, Facebook, but is not employed by Facebook. And what that means, of course, is that their pay is very much below what a someone employed inside Facebook would actually be making. They have very different employment conditions. You know, the relative lack of benefits, maybe absence of benefits, things like health care and whatnot. Excuse me. And so there's this is a, you know, a clear example of uneven power relationships. And so it is that's just one case that we explore in the book to try and demonstrate how thinking discard studies is about thinking about how systems work and recognizing that any system, as I say, has to get rid of people, places, and things in order to maintain its systemic ordering.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the social media moderation example, because that was kind of the moment in the book where, you know, I'm reading along, you're like talking about recycling and talking about plastic bag bans and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I expected this book to be about. And then you hit us with, so now we're going to apply this theory to social media content moderation. And I was like, oh, okay, this book is doing something really interesting and different.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can say a little bit more about that in that I think that this direction of getting at systems beyond those that relate to trash or garbage in the conventional senses was a direction that discard studies was headed but hadn't yet really been, you know, kind of written down and tried to link together in a coherent way, a set of concepts that would kind of draw that out. But for me, it was this really crucial conceptual shift, and why for my own research, I feel much happier thinking of myself as someone who engages with discard studies as opposed to waste studies, although I have published in waste studies as a field. And as we say in the book, these two fields can overlap, but we argue that waste studies isn't necessarily and automatically discard studies.
Right. You're not trying to discard waste studies.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Some of my best friends are waste studies.
Right. So then another case study that kind of runs through the book, that's another one that maybe people wouldn't expect to see in a book like this, is the COVID-19 pandemic. So can you say something about how does discard studies help us understand the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah. So Max and I started writing this book before the pandemic, but even as it was taking off, it was becoming very clear that the ideas that we were trying to articulate, that discard studies is a way of understanding systems in terms of that any system, in order to be what it is, has to get rid of people, places, and things. As the pandemic was taking off, we were, I suppose, surprised. I'm trying to avoid the word delighted because it seems like such a, such a terrible experience that has been going on with the pandemic, you know, and as we try to get into a little bit in the book, in very brutally differentiated ways. But as COVID-19 was taking off, we were seeing so many of different interlocking systems starting to be increasingly laid bare by, in part, for example, by, you know, who was being made sacrificable, right, to the pandemic. You know, we had the designation of people in different jurisdictions, you know, legally deemed essential workers. And there's a lot packed into that, but just even at a fairly superficial level, you could look at different jurisdictions and just start listing the occupations that were deemed essential. And one of the things you notice is that not all jurisdictions had the same list. So this broader idea that, discard studies has to be very careful about avoiding universalisms. Things are highly differentiated, you know, geographically, temporally, etc., is really important. Also, when you looked at these jurisdictions and you look at different jurisdictions and you looked at the types of jobs deemed essential, you know, now 2.5 years into the pandemic, it may be, you know, it's undeniably obvious, I think, to probably many, if not most people, but early on it was, only clear in some places that were collecting, for example, racialized data, that the occupations deemed essential also were heavily racialized as non-white. And that's not an accident. So we were, what COVID was and is showing us is how a whole variety of systems, industrial systems or economic systems, capitalism, if you want to use that term, white supremacy and racialization, and so on, you know, interlock and have highly differential consequences for, to move very quickly, who's included and who's excluded, right? Who is brought in and who is discarded and how?
Yeah. For folks that maybe haven't encountered discard studies or waste studies or anything in this kind of area before, I think one thing that they may be familiar with is the observation by Mary Douglas that dirt is matter out of place. And so you spend some time in the book kind of engaging with Douglas's perspective as sort of one of the sort of foundations, but also something that needs to be critiqued in different ways by the field. So can you say a little bit about, you know, what you find useful and not useful about Mary Douglas's work?
For sure. So yes, that quote from Mary Douglas is a key concept in the field. Dirt is matter out of place, and it's really Max who's done some really great public writing and thinking initially on the Discard Studies blog about the meaning of that aphorism or concept and the need for folks who are engaged in discard studies to really be mindful of its implications. So for those not already familiar with the concept or the saying, dirt is matter out of place, Mary Douglas was an anthropologist, and she was comparing various religious and cultural systems and making this point that we depend on very heavily in the book, that those religious or cultural systems have certain categories of things that she describes as dirt, and these are things that offer sort of fundamental challenges to the overall order that this or that religious or cultural system in question makes of the world. And so there are examples that she takes from various cultures around the world. And we certainly agree with her point. Not just agree, I mean, it's incredibly conceptually useful for thinking about how power and systems work. But part of what we talk about in the book is the way that too often Douglass's phrase, dirt is matter out of place, is applied to trash or garbage in the conventional sense that, you know, the plastic water bottle in the gutter is an instance of dirt that is matter out of place. And in fact, as Mary Douglas herself in her own writing says, trash or garbage in that sense is not dirt because it doesn't represent a fundamental challenge to the overall ordering system of which it's part. A water bottle in the gutter is might be misplaced or displaced in that it hasn't made it into the bin, whether that's a garbage bin or a recycling bin, but that such a place exists means that that water bottle in the gutter doesn't represent a challenge, right? There is a place to put it. So dirt, as Mary Douglas describes it, is something that truly does not fit and threatens in a kind of existential way whatever system the person, place, or thing is an instance of. I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, definitely. So then the final chapter of the book, you raise the issue of how to discard well, because you're saying, you're not saying that like we should never discard anything. That's not a possible or feasible situation. So we should think about how to discard well. So can you give us some sort of pointers in the direction of thinking about how to discard well?
For sure. Yeah. No, thanks for asking this. So one of the things we had to contend with was that if indeed our proposal that all systems discard, then that means if our thinking is systematic, then we too have to discard. There's no getting around it. And this is a broader point that we make throughout the book, that systems, just because they discard that, you know, that doesn't mean only, as it were, in quotes, you know, bad systems discard and we'll reach this magical time and place when we'll find systems that don't discard. We're making the claim that for systems to be what they are, they have to get rid of people, places, and things one way or another. So yes, we spend the last chapter trying to lay out a way of discarding well. And we make a couple of points. One is that there's not going to be a universal recipe. We can't offer a way that's going to work always and everywhere in a guaranteed kind of way, but we can offer some, let's call them orientations as opposed to a list of things to do. So when thinking about how, if a reader is interested in how they might discard well, or the systems that they are part of might discard well, the first thing to think about is moving from describing how the system is now to how one thinks it ought to be. What would a better organization of the system in question be? And there's a way to do that by asking yourself some questions about, you know, what goods are goods in the sense of let's say moral goods, are being sought, and what bads, if you will, are being fought. That's a question that comes out of some work in science and technology studies, and authors in that field. After thinking about thinking about how things ought to be organized, it's also important to think through specificity. So think about the specifics of a given case that a system is or is part of. We go into an example in the book where we start talking about snow clearing, for example, in a city in Sweden, and we talk about which may sound like a leap. I can get into it more if we want, but we go from an example where snow clearing very much favored a sort of male-dominated places of work and was rearranged to favor pedestrians, who statistically speaking were more likely to be women doing care work. And that change in that system managed to achieve some goods, but one of the things that it didn't manage to change was the creation of tire dust on roadways, which are major pollutants. And we talk about how in looking to discard well, you need to be specific. You won't be able to do everything everywhere all at once, as it were. And so you have to be very cognizant of the connecting the action that you are considering taking with the ends that you want to achieve. So that's back to that concept of scale. And the specific relationships that matter. Third, when thinking about discarding well, you want to be thinking about dealing with, be sure you're dealing with systems rather than symptoms. Litter in the gutter is a symptom of a broader industrial organization devoted to disposability, for example. So you might, if you truly want to deal with disposability, that's a much different thing than, say, putting some recycling bins at the curbside. That doesn't mean don't put recycling bins at the curbside, but putting recycling bins at the curbside isn't going to match up to the system of disposability. We also talk about discarding well, that it's important to be accountable to what is discarded. This can be a little bit tricky to convey, but we went through a case study in the last chapter where we had developed a case study that dealt with a specific example of indigenous sovereignty, that the sort of entry point to it was waste and trash in a conventional sense occurring at campsites, and how an indigenous nation developed a set of protocols that would have led to, or not would have led to, permits being necessary for people to come on to this nation's lands to engage in a variety of different practices, camping, but also harvesting of wild plants. And that is about as much as I can say about that case, because one of the things that, as we say, we're concerned about in discarding well is being accountable. And we felt it was important that we would have permission of the nation to tell these stories before using them for our own purposes in our book, because to simply assume that we could take these stories and tell our own story about them for our own purposes is a very colonial move, right? That is to discard practices of indigenous sovereignty. Not cool, not something we wanted to do. So that was a way of being accountable, was to first try to seek permission. We almost got it over a series of communications over many months, but we didn't quite. And so what we did was discard the case study and talk about the specific policy relating to research involving indigenous groups that is in operation at the university that we work with, as a way of describing how we attempted to be accountable and discard well. So hopefully that's a little bit more concrete.
Yeah. And so with that case study, we reach kind of the end of the last chapter of the book, but it's not the last thing in the book that I wanted to ask you about, because I took a look at your citations, your list of references, and you begin that with a little discussion of citational practice, and you give like some statistics about the gender balance of the scholars that you cited. So I wanted to ask you to talk a bit about, you're clearly very conscious about how you were making use of existing research and who you were citing. And so I wondered if you could talk a bit about how that process worked for you and kind of the impact that had on the book.
Yeah, this is really crucial. And I really have learned a great deal from Max on this. And this is very much their work in the book and teachings for me to learn for sure. So Max, not just in this book, but in other work that they publish, they have paid a great deal of attention to what sometimes gets called citational politics, which in a sort of simplistic way is about, you know, who gets cited by whom and about what. And over and over and over again, when citational practices are studied, there is a systematic tendency for women, for Black, for people of color, people who are indigenous, to not be cited, even though they, you know, work in this or that field that's in question. And you know, despite our own, meaning Max and my own growing awareness of those issues, and our own like very explicit attempt to do better in terms of who we cite and how, we ran the bibliography once we were finished through. An online tool, which is, it has its limits to be sure, but we ran it through an online tour, a tool that attempts to measure the gender balance of the citations made. And despite our best efforts, we had something like 30% plus of women authored work in our bibliography. And interestingly, without throwing shade on the press, when it came time to copy editing the manuscript, the initial copy edits had taken out a bunch of references we had in our bibliography to Twitter threads on these topics of citational politics, often by women of color. And so even as we had tried to include them, the publishing process, i.e. a system, had been at work in terms of discarding. And so we had to go back and say, no, these tweets need to stay in as cited work. And, this it was not hard to ask to get it done, but the very fact that we had to is itself a signal, right, about how systems of citational politics work, if that makes sense.
And so this book is available for purchase for anyone that wants to read it, but it's also available open access, so you can pull up each chapter.
It is. We're very excited for that, and we're very thankful, Max and I are very thankful to the press who arranged open access. We did try to work that into our contract negotiations right from go, but it was only after the manuscript was sent for printing, actually, that we learned indeed the press had found funding to make it open access. So the entire book is available chapter by chapter from MIT Press for open access use. And we were really trying to get this done in part because we wanted to make the book useful for teaching, and we hope that people will find it useful in those ways.
Yeah, as a teacher, it's great if I can, you know, just have my students read one chapter out of this if it's relevant to a particular lesson. And it's much easier when it's available open access like that.
Exactly.
Okay, so as we're moving toward the end of our time here, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing this book.
Well, certainly a shout out to Max. It would be impossible to have written this book. I couldn't have written this book by myself. This is very much writing and thinking together. So my thanks to Max for that ongoing collaboration. And there's so many. Who else to thank? My family, but they have their own projects that they're engaged with. So I'm just thankful that they are there and I am with them.
And we always like to end by asking what you're working on next.
Sure. I have ongoing research around back to the topic of electronics. I'm very much into analyzing electronics as an industrial sector from an environmentally grounded point of view, and particularly drawing attention, documenting pollution and waste arising upstream in the manufacturing and mining necessary for electronics, as well as thinking about repair, both repair of devices, but increasingly repair of, for want of a better term, the landscapes that these broader industrial systems rely on for their existence.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Stenter. That was great.
You just heard a conversation with Josh Leposky, co-author, along with Max Liboron, of Discard Studies, Wasting Systems and Power, published this year by MIT Press.